I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello and welcome to episode number 87 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. At the end of this podcast, in the outro, I want to tell you about my handmade, hand-painted dark stars. So after the podcast, stay tuned and I'll tell you all about them. This week I'm taking you to meet someone that has been a visual artist and a musician stroke songwriter for as long as he can remember. Performing on his own as Mr. Solo and later as lead singer of David Devon and his spirit wife, Mikey Georgeson enjoyed closely interacting with his audience, something that he brought along to his visual work. Lee Ainsworth invited me along to the Roundhouse in Islington several years ago to go and see David Devon and his spirit wife, and they really were something quite amazing. And funnily enough, last year, Mikey was sat in the audience of the auditorium when I was giving a talk at the University of East London. Mikey Johnson is a multidisciplined artist that uses everything from painting, drawing, video, installation, performance. Everything gets used in his practice. And in 2019, after 5 years studying, Mikey was awarded a doctorate at the University of East London. Now, I'm not going to be talking here in the intro about Mikey's work, because he does it oh so eloquently himself. So please, come with me and meet Mikey Georgeson. Do you use the B in your name?
Oh, what? My B? Benedict?
Yeah, I saw that Instagram is Mikey B.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the B when you spoke to Stu. Oh, you said, I thought you was going to use the B.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether you was saying to him that you use the B.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
You don't.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd ask.
I don't know if I can post-rationalise it, Gary, but I think it's, you know, my tendency to take everything and make it matter for expression. So, like, names.
Yeah.
I just keep changing it.
I love
it.
That attitude.
Oh, Mikey B. Georgeson, that sounds funny. Or that's yeah. Tactile. I'll add that.
Yeah.
And then my friend Mark Desarney is a DJ on Radio Caroline, and he lives
nice.
He lives half the year in a hilltop principality. It is literally a principality called Seborgo.
Wow.
And we went out to stay with him, and the night I got there, he interviewed me from midnight to 2 in the morning. It was like, I'd been thinking, yeah, I've achieved a lot by arriving here. No, you've got to do an interview now. And I sat down with him in his little studio to do the interview, and he's got his mixing desk, and I'm just sitting there with the headphones on, and then suddenly this voice comes into my headphones. Hello, and it's an amazing radio station, and I'm here with Mikey B. Georgeson. And I look round, and it was actually Mark. And I was like, yeah. But that's that sort of reinforced my love of that Mikey B. Georgeson. So that's why one of the reasons I started using it, I think, is good, just to change it.
Was it one of those moments where you think, who's that? Oh, it's me.
Yeah, yeah. No, continually having those moments, yeah. But I think a lot of artists talk, I mean, you might have even talked about that, the imposter syndrome. It's quite no.
I've come to the decision that anyone who hasn't had it is an imposter.
Yeah. I think that is probably very true. Yeah.
I have seven questions, Mikey, that I ask each artist.
Yeah.
The first being, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
Yeah, that's a good. I suppose the short answer is, you know, I'm a multidisciplinary artist interested in the relational experience of the emergence of understanding and meaning, shared meaning, through a relational experience. And I can do that in a multidisciplinary way. So that's the one answer. I suppose I just finished a doctorate last year, and what I found on that was this idea of aesthetic machines, and they are creating a space where I can understand through feeling, and the audience understands with me through feeling, and the excess of meaning beyond conceptual engagement as a very real part of our collective understanding. And that the reason I mention that is because it enabled me to realize that I'm a songwriter and a painter, and I really love making films, and they are all my capacities. So fulfillment of capacities is something that I'm on the side of. You know, I don't want anything that inhibits that. I think it's good to promote a creative, expansive, operating at full potential. So then with an aesthetic machine, I was able to just happily combine painting, songwriting, singing, poems, constructing, building, and working with my friend John, who helps me build things in the garden. He becomes part of my art, and our relationship is not something that's hidden from the work.
All those areas you mentioned there, have they always been interlinked, or was it through doing a doctorate that you sort of pulled them all in together?
Well, that's it. It's because culturally, you know, we kind of operate on a system of separation. So you've got to choose something.
Exactly.
Like the careers advisor. And I once was in a relationship with a lovely girl, who told me I should pick one thing. And that was because at that time I'd just formed a band, and I was also an artist. And I thought, no, I don't want to pick one thing. But it took me 20 years and the doctorate to kind of find the writers and the thinkers that helped me kind of put that in a context. So that I wasn't like a painter who did songs, because I was with a gallery who have been very supportive of me. I was still in touch with them, Sartorial Art, run by Greta Sarfati, and I'm still collaborating with her. But even then, I still got a sort of sense that, oh yeah, Mikey's a painter and he does songs, but the doctorate helped me bring them all together in that.
Nice.
Yeah.
And how did you How did you find it there at UEL, at University of East London?
Yeah, yeah. The doctorate was so hard, but fantastic. Yeah. I've told other people, I once saw a therapist and told them that I felt like I needed this challenge, something that was going to really stretch me creatively yeah. and intellectually. And I think that was the doctorate, but I did it 20 wow. years later.
But it's great how these things come along. You know, if you would have found it then, maybe it weren't the time for it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm a big believer in that. I think the timing of things helps to make things, helps you to own your understanding of something.
I was in prison for years, and I'd discovered art while I was in there. And that was in my mid-20s.
Yeah.
And like I say to so many people, if I would have discovered art when I was at school, or you know, even after I'd left school, I wouldn't have done all of that. I wouldn't be in prison, because art did change my life, you know. It gave me a completely 180 degree look on life, you know. And if I would have found it younger, I wouldn't have been there. But then again, without that experience, I wouldn't be the person
absolutely
I am,
and you're much richer. I completely agree with that attitude. I don't think there's any point in looking back and, you know, those, if you could change something in your life, blah blah blah. It's like, no, I'm here, this is what's emerging, and that's part of that sort of idea of always being in the middle of and that I think is a sort of positive vitalist approach to life, you know. It's like,
well, that bad point in mind has become the narrative throughout everything I've done since.
Yeah, well, I was at your talk and I, you know, immediately got that sense of, it's not about regret, it's about what comes out, what emerges
definitely.
From that. Yeah.
Yeah, they scared the life out of me, them talks, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's a big theatre, that, isn't it?
Yeah, very. Very.
I've never spoken in that theatre, so.
No, before, I'd done it a couple of years before.
Yeah.
And we was in, where was we? We wasn't there. I think we was in the new building, and that was okay.
Yeah.
But then when they told me I was doing it in that theatre.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, me heart, me heart went a bit. And that is that's quite an intimidating place to stand and
it's good to do, though, isn't it? Yeah, it gets the adrenaline going.
But I've got to say, within 2 or 3 minutes, I'd forgotten that, you know. Once the nerves went,
absolutely.
Okay.
You didn't seem nervous.
not outside possibly, but inside. The people you work with at UEL, I mean, I'll always bang the drum of UEL from my time there. It was bloody amazing. So were the tutors, and I've been in touch with. I left there in 2004.
Yeah,
and I'm still in touch with many of the tutors there.
They're
16
great.
16 years later. Gary's on the doctorate as well, isn't he?
Yeah, Docker. Gary's finished it. Yeah.
I love Gary. He's great, isn't he?
Yeah, his work's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it for a few years.
Yeah.
But I saw him, I think, was it when I gave my talk? Well, it might have been a little while. No, it's when I gave my talk, I think.
Yeah.
I was with Gary then.
Yeah.
Is he still working there?
Yeah, absolutely. All beavering away. We're all getting ready for the new term of what they call dual delivery, you know, online. If we have to suddenly retreat, we have to be able to keep it going.
What are you doing at UEL now?
Yeah, I do contextual studies, and that's on foundation. Recently, I've been working with the MA students, Emma Maguire. Do you know Emma?
You must know. She's come. I helped her do her third year show when she was a student. I was paired with her to assist her, and she's been me mate ever since. She's coming on here. We just couldn't tie the date down.
Oh, cool, yeah. Well, Emma, over lockdown, invited me in to help assess the MA Fine Art, and they've built a virtual reality exhibition, which has blown my mind, really. in terms of how the lockdown virtual experience has sort of compressed learning into something really intense and explosively accelerational. You know, it's like people have learned stuff which might take a whole year within a month because they're putting on this big scale exhibition in a virtual environment, and we're able to talk to them as curatorial assistants. And and something like that you just could not do within an analog space. And also, you know, that the virtual relationship, it means that you the feedback is much quicker, and then you can see them learning from it, putting on this ambitious show. You know, one student who's a photographer just had had the walls completely black at one point. And we suggested just lightening them a bit. And can you imagine how long that would take in the real world?
Exactly.
But lightening it just suddenly turned it into an experience rather than something that was like a sort of just flat picture.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking to, I'd done a podcast with Richard Wilson, the sculptor, yesterday.
Yeah.
And he was saying how this sort of technology has moved on, advanced 10 years in the last 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing the things that we're all having to do, and, you know, the hurdles we're sort of crossing over as artists, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what sort of happened is there's a sort of chink or a crack in the structure that the institution couldn't fill, and we've filled that, and it's become very progressive and technologically exciting because I suppose we're like artists colonizing this virtual space because we've had to, and using it very creatively. I mean, the students I've worked with have all really blossomed through developing what I call a sense of your agency, which is, you know, I used to wonder about where my ideas come from, especially, you know, when I formed a band called David Devont and his Spirit Wife, and we had some success, you know, and I wrote music that I'd never kind of dreamt that I would write before, and it used to bother me that I could do this and I didn't really know what was happening because it didn't feel like I was thinking it up. I was kind of living it through a relational experience and kind of an exuberance for what we were doing. And I think that's what I would call agency, is like understanding that that process is part of your identity as a creative, as an intelligent human. It's not just a bit at school where you learn to answer questions in a certain way, that can actually rob people of their sense of agency.
Would there be, you're talking about David Devont and his Spirit Wife.
Yeah.
Is there any similarities in the way you approach creating a song to how you approach creating a painting, a drawing, an artwork?
Well, I think writing a chord sequence is different to like struggling with you know, how to lay down formal colour and paint on a painting, but they're very similar in that there's I get pleasure from working. That's the chord sequence that I want. I can hear that. And I've found it, and I've found how that blue relates to that blue. And my way into that could be from an idea or a lyric or a tune. And likewise, I'm doing a painting at the moment called The Case of the Missing Shade of Blue. And that could be a song, it could be a painting.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's a painting, which I then thought, that could be a film because I meditate. So I film myself meditating in front of the painting. So that's the thing that the doctorate helped me validate. You know, I suppose a lot of artists, we want a context to feel valid. You know, because we're not completely invulnerable. So,
well, while it's being created, Mike, it's only you that believes in it, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
Once it's created, then you've got to try and convince other people to believe in that as well, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And validate it, like you just say.
Well, I think as well, one of the things that I find myself saying to students a lot, at least once a term, is I'll look at an artist, say like El Greco, and I'll go, no one told him to go and do that kind of art. There was no one doing it, you know, the way he kind of totally bent the rules of perspective, made figures expressive, made the landscape a sort of manifestation of his interior life. There was no one around to validate that and go, well done, El Greco. I think you should go and do this kind of groundbreaking art. So it's like you say, it's just you that believes in it. You know, it's like, I didn't know, is there an art form where you're allowed to meditate in front of a painting? What's that called? I mean, so I came up with aesthetic machines. So then everything I do, that's an aesthetic machine. Because it's relational, creates an environment for other people to engage.
The reason I asked that question is because, as you were saying there, I don't know audio. You know, I've been doing a podcast for 2 years.
Yeah.
And when it comes to editing, I had no idea how to edit. But the only way I could associate myself with it was use it as I do Photoshop, as in the cutting and pasting and putting together.
Yeah,
and then I see them all as shapes now, rather than noises, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I love it. Do you know the artist Burial? Yeah, I found out about him because of the writer K-Punk, who was
I know K-Punk.
Yeah, and he talked about Burial, and so I looked into Burial. And he just broke all the rules with sound. You know, he took lots of sound off YouTube videos, and he very much edited his music like videos, I think. Yeah. So it's a bit like when I first started making artist books. It's not something I've done recently, but I just sort of had this sense of looking around going, am I allowed to just, like, make books like this? And take them to shops, and I did. You know, and like they went all over the world, which was, you know, really rewarding. But it's you know, you make your own methodology. That's the word they use on the doctorate. What's your methodology? And I suppose a lot of the time people might look to other people's methodologies, but where we get innovation is, like you're saying, is find your own method. And then spend time enjoying it and doing it.
Go with what you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I got criticised a couple of years ago. I put a group show together.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of the group show was just a concept work of art, which included using 30 artists' work as found objects.
Yeah.
I put down that it's a group show and a one-man show. Or a solo show.
Yeah.
Because of the concept. And I was getting criticised that I can't call it a one-man show if there's 29 other artists in it.
Yeah.
But my thing was, the whole thing was a conceptual piece of artwork.
Well, I completely get that. It's relational. It's about the emergence. And in a way, you know, I'm talking about how you can take every part of life and treat it as matter for expression. And you gathering these artists is part of that concept.
Yeah.
You know, my concept is that concepts emerge out of a felt experience rather than the art following on from a concept. So that's my concept.
Was there art in your family growing up?
Well, yeah. That I had to write about that in my doctorate thesis, they call it, because my dad was my art teacher, my father was my art teacher, and my fellow students ended up calling him Dad. Yeah.
Well, if he can, why can't we?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was great. I was talking to my dad the other day about his paintings because I think they must have been very influential on me. I can remember them individually, and they are sort of within that frieze of paintings that have influenced me. You know, there's one, a still life of a clown and an oil lamp that he did, which, you know, I've got there alongside Stuart Davis, jazz abstracts.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's a great painter. We had a show in 2009 at the Bear Gallery in Camberwell called Father, Son and Holy Smoke. So it was like his paintings and my paintings, and then the event, you know, what? Because I wanted to see what it would be like if we showed paintings together. What will happen? You know, that,
And did they sit well together?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, he's much more formal than me, I suppose, and he's interested in formal issues, you know, colour, composition. But we both love paint, and I suppose he gave me my love of paint.
Yeah,
he's technically a fucking excellent painter. I don't, you know, there's not many... In terms of, you know,
colour's quite prominent in yours, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, like a lot of art students, I was sort of put off colour at art school because it's like, oh, you can't do that. You can't put that colour there. And you've got to know your theory. And at some point, I went down to the print room because I started making big monoprint linos. And I was just by myself mixing up the colours. And I was thinking of sweet shops. And when you go in a sweet shop and all those colours and the joy of that. And I just went from there, really, you know. And I think, you know, that doesn't mean I'm abandoning my sense of tonality and what colours do together and assimilating theory as I go. But it also means that I want to dive into colour and feel how they work. It's a bit like we were saying earlier about using audio technology. You know, how it sounds and is what is important. So whether your mic is cheap or expensive. So likewise with colour, does it work? What's it doing? How do you feel? You know, that these are all aesthetic things that, because you're working intuitively, it doesn't mean you're abandoning your ability to make decisions.
No,
yeah. So,
when was it you decided you wanted to be an artist?
Good question. And I sort of thought about this because I knew I was going to talk to you, like, at, because, you know, I was at school. I think I wanted to be a good pupil. And I kind of assimilated that careers advice attitude, which is sort of reductionist. And I was going to be an illustrator because, you know, oh, I like art and I want to make a living. And I went to Chelsea School of Art, and my tutors were all painters. So it was like, something, you know, it's like... My horizons expanded, having thought I'd be like Janet and John, nice pictures.
Yeah.
It's like I looked over at this person doing the massive collage monoprint.
Yeah.
It's like, that's different. And then there were these illustrators, Archer and Cornell, who are still around doing different things. Magda's married to Harry Hill, Magda Archer.
Oh, yeah.
And I looked in their studio and they had like a fake poo in the middle of a frame and it said Naughty Fido. That's just like, so that's illustration. But then what I was thinking about is how I just thought I'm not going to be a musician at that point. I think I formed a band at art college, but, you know, it wasn't to really do anything. And then when I went, I moved to Brighton for my MA, which was part time, and I found myself immersed in like this maelstrom of aesthetic creative relations, and something, it was like tapped into me, and it was like, oh, you can just be this completely other thing. Yeah. Because the other guys in the band had all done fine art, and so again, I'd relate that to my understanding of myself, is that, you know, I didn't really, I've never kind of thought in terms of cause and effect and determinism and like deciding. It's more about like moving through life, feeling where my passions are and following that. And that, I guess, is when I wanted to be an artist, when I joined David Duvonney's Spirit Wife.
Well, you definitely use art. Art definitely features in your gigs. I've been to less than a handful of gigs in my life.
Yeah.
I'm not very good with crowds.
Yeah.
But I think I've been to 3, possibly 4 gigs ever.
Yeah.
One of them was David Duvonney and his Spirit Wife.
Oh,
my friend Lee,
yeah,
who's a big fan, he said about yous, and I come along and I absolutely loved it. I mean, I'm not just saying that because, you know, because we're speaking to you, but absolutely loved it. What a gig it was. At the Roundhouse it was, in his probably 2004, round about the end when I finished uni.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, so that would have been about the time of our third album, Power Words for Better Living. Might have even been the launch for that album. That was all about balloon animals. I got, because I had got kids at that point, they were quite young. And so I would entertain them by, I taught myself how to make balloon animals.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, this is my new art form, my new métier. And so it wasn't a gig where we got the crowd to tie balloon animals.
It wasn't, not that I can remember. I mean, I was quite near the back. I can't be around, you know, I can't be near the front. Yeah, all I can remember is Auntie Mabel.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I don't know the real title of the song.
Well, no, I've always been hard to pin titles down. It is called Auntie Mabel, but the chorus is, I'm not even going to try.
Oh, I love it. It sounds like I'm brown nosing here, I know, but I loved that. Yeah. It felt like I was being like pulled in by the other audience members, you know, to join them at that point.
Yeah, I talk about that stuff. It's like there's so much to process by being involved in David Duvonney's Spirit Wife, because unlike my previous musical incarnations where I was sort of striving to think it up, I'm like an audience member in David Duvonney. You know, I am there writing songs and doing stuff, but the stuff that seems to come out of it, I don't completely understand, and I understand it through the audience as well, just like this.
Well, I did make a note here. I did see a little quote that you put, I don't even think it was your quote.
Yeah.
But it said that it was talking about Trope at the Royal Standard in Liverpool.
Oh, yeah.
And it said, the cracks that open between the audience and the artist does feel like you have, or you want to have, that connection between the artist and the audience. That it did feel like that was quite important to you.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's very much, I can't think of another word. It's like a prehension. It's not a comprehension. It's something, I feel the understanding of that, and I can't sort of do a plan to make that happen. I can just sort of feel how I'd like that to happen. Yeah. And what's interesting is we don't really do as much of the performance art at the moment in the gigs, but there's still that still happens, that relationality with the audience. And it's not like audience participation, because I'm not really a fan of forced participation.
I really dislike that. I'm almost scared of it. But I'll gladly get up and do something if I get the urge to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's, I didn't ever go to raves and things like that, but it might be like our version of that sort of communal ritual, isn't it? It's a ritual, yeah, where you all create the meaning together. I went to there's a show called The Visitors by an artist that I really like, but he's got a really complicated name. And I always, because I think I am a bit dyspraxic, or it's Ratgar. He's called Ragnar Kjartansson.
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know where I know the name from.
Well, he's good because, I mean, he also uses music within his installations, and he paints. But I went to his show, The Visitors, and I remember looking round at everyone in it, and it was like, we've all got this feeling, and I don't normally get that in art exhibitions, where you sort of feel connected to the rest of the people in the gallery.
Yeah.
It's like, are you feeling this? It's like you look at someone and this is quite cosmic, isn't it? Something is happening to me as an organism. And you look at each other and you're feeling it. So that experiential connection is something I enjoy.
Well, it yeah. didn't feel like you was just singing one of your old songs. You know, you was doing your routine. Yeah. It felt like you were singing it for the first time.
That's emergence, you know, being surfacing into the world in the middle of things. And that's what writing a song, making a painting, that is singing it live. And that's the thing that I try and capture in every bit of art that I do, I suppose. And in a way, I was just reading about William Blake, because I'm curating the William Blake exhibition, and one of his best poems that he writes about the fourfold vision, which is not the singular vision of school sort of learning, singular vision, like we have fourfold vision. And I, you know, that is really famous line, but he actually just wrote it in a letter to his Thomas Butts. It was a letter, you know. So it's the way he didn't differentiate between the personal and his art. Yeah. It's all like one flow. Yeah. So that flow, I suppose, like our gigs are like just a point in time in that flow. Yeah.
It was, as I say, it was a really unifying experience for me. For someone that, as I say, I steer clear of crowds to my detriment, because I know we've got a mutual friend, Stu Whiffin, and Stu is just an encyclopedia of musicians, bands, gigs.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
He's always going on about the gigs he's been to, and I would love, I'd love to be able to experience that when I hear him talk, because he's so bloody passionate about it.
Yeah.
And I do realise and feel that I've missed out on a lot because of that sort of fear of crowds, you know, but what can you do? Which is for courses.
Well, it's all changed now, isn't
exactly,
it? Like, you're the new normal.
I'm thriving.
You're ahead of the curve.
I mean, I'm an ex-prisoner, so I'm used to being on my own. None of us like crowds, so this is my ideal environment at the moment.
Yeah.
What piece that you've created has got the strongest emotional connection with you?
That's a good question. There's a couple. I think a lot of my art post 2000, because I did a lot of the childcare, you know, because we both work. And so, like, being with my sons, they were, like, coming into my art. And I made a piece of art for Blakefest. Well, actually, I say I made it for Blakefest, but that's kind of reducing why I made it. I was asked to curate Blakefest, you know, about William Blake. And I was flattered, but at the same time I thought, I'm not sure that I can connect to his art and the way it looks and feels. And then suddenly I realised that this piece I'd been planning would fit perfectly. And that ended up being a piece called Dandelion Visions, which is on my website. And it's about how I was with my son, Ralph, and I was driving him in the early morning to his swimming lessons, because he used to do like competitive swimming, so he'd have to get up really early. And the sun was coming up behind the trees, and it was that time of year when there's like loads of dandelions, and the air was full of dandelion seeds, and the sun shining through them. So the piece ended up translating that to dandelion hyperdrive, and I built a car, and I read a poem within that space. And the poem is about how time becomes entangled, because I realised the road I was on was the same one my dad used to drive me to school down. And so the poem is like a reflection and a churning over of art and human relations, and how do we step outside of the strictures of human conceptual thought.
Because
at that brief moment in the dandelion hyperdrive, I did, you know, I was there with my son at my side, and strangely I was in his position looking at me as if I was looking at my own dad. And I remembered in the poem it says, "With a little luck" was on the radio, and I'm getting goosebumps now actually, because that's a Paul McCartney song. And I remember that mixture of fear and optimism as my dad drove me to school with that song on the radio.
Wow.
So that piece, Dandelion Visions, is kind of about, just the temporal thinking of stepping outside of linear thought and connect. Everything connects. Emotion, and that I suppose brings emotion much more to the surface, rather than it being a layered thing.
I love the idea that it's that the story is about you. It's about three generations, but there's only you who remember or know of that whole story, and everything you've just said, like, you know, your father and your son are gonna be sort of ignorant to the fact of how much that little thing meant to you.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's really that's sort of what I feel reality is sort of, it's all our drops of experience all amassed together,
I was just about to say, that's what we're all built up of, is all of these little tiny experiences that bond us to everyone around us. You know, that's the strength that it gives us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really funny you should say that, though, because my dad, who I've been having some great chats with, but he keeps saying, you're probably too young to remember. And I'm going, no, I was there. Yeah.
Where do you go to relax, Mike? Or what do you do to relax?
Oh, that's a good one question. Of those. Yeah. Well, I do a few things. I love walking. Especially, I walk with my sons, which is good. Where do we go for our nice walks? We've got a nice walk near us, Leechpool Woods. But I tell you, I took Arthur, my eldest son, who's doing chemistry at university. We went to Knepp Castle, which is a ruin, and things like that really help me relax, cut, and sort of just enter another space. It's this ruin that I've passed on the it's not a motorway, it's a dual carriageway, but you see it from the side of the road. For years I've seen it and just thought, I want to go there. I parked in the road next to it, and you can't get through. And then over lockdown, it's on this estate called the Knepp Estate, and they've opened themselves up for walkers. It used to be a farm estate, but they've changed it into more of a rural safari experience.
Yeah.
But I went on it and I wandered round and round looking for the route to it, and eventually, after getting lost, I found it. And it was almost a religious experience. You know, it's just this weird arch ruin with a lightning conductor on the top of it, on top of a mound. And I took Arthur there the other day, and I was saying, oh, it's really weird because you can get a bit lost here, even though it looks like a simple route. And lo and behold, yeah, we got lost on the way back. It, and I was saying to him, that's brilliant, isn't it? If we got lost.
Yeah, yeah. How far is it from like where you've seen it to where it actually is?
Oh, yeah, well, when you drive past it, it's like you're about 30 yards away from it. But to get to it, you have to park about a couple of miles away.
It's a long old trek.
Yeah, yeah. And but beautiful. The other obvious thing I do to relax is meditate. I learnt TM because David Lynch, that's the meditation he learnt. And have you ever tried meditation?
No. Last week it was a forced meditation, yeah, and I couldn't get on with it.
Yeah.
I was told that I should meditate with this person, and I didn't like that.
Yeah, well, I have tried lots and found it really difficult. And it's really weird because I went to learn, and basically the guy teaching me is going, you know, the point about this is it's easy. And if you're trying it, you're not doing it properly, you know, so you've got to not try. And I kept wanting to go, that's really funny you should say that, because I've written a song about that. And it was like I'd come home. It's like, yeah, I'm not even going to try it. I totally got it. It's like, well, if you want to relax, you've got to become unencumbered. Yeah. And that, yeah. I mean, that helps with all sorts of stuff, really.
Now, I've always been tempted to do it, never really done it. I feel so self-conscious when I'm about to start, and it's silly. It's throughout my life, Mikey, I've held myself back with that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, I think we all do, though. Bloody shit. You know, it's like I was talking to Emma earlier, Emma Maguire, the artist, about how you've got to, like, get past the tripwires of your inner cynic. That's what I found when I began to understand my own creative process, is I somehow navigated my way past my inner cynic and found, actually, this stuff is really nutritious and helpful.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
well, I've learned from what you're talking about there, I've learned to sort of rebel against that inner critic.
Yeah.
Only in the last 4 or so years, because I got to a point when I was sort of approaching the 50s.
Yeah.
And I was like, fucking, I've let so many opportunities go by
where
I've just been embarrassed or afraid of the consequences, you know, or I've been in a gallery and I've not, you know, I've not vocalised an idea and it's gone past. And that is one of the reasons why I started this podcast.
Yeah.
Was because I knew that I did have a voice, but I was scared to sort of let anyone hear it. And then I realised that all of that's a load of bollocks.
Yeah, as
and
they say.
Any voice is welcome. It just depends on how many people want to listen to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, now I'm self-conscious. My wife even said to me, did you have elocution lessons as a child? And I was like, I don't know where... you know what I think it is? I mean, because even when I was at school, my schoolmates would occasionally pick me up on speaking correctly, because I speak quite clearly. And it might be because I've got hearing loss, so I overcompensate. I don't know. But I do love words and the material vitality of words. So it could just be...
See, I love that as well. And funnily enough, when I started at UEL, the person that I pallied up with, first of all, was a guy called Pete.
Yeah.
He was similar age to me, but he had gone to military school.
Wow.
When he was a child, you know, yeah. I didn't even know there was such a thing over
there.
He was, and he spoke with such poeticness, if that's even a word.
Yeah, yeah.
It was beautiful. Like, we could both be talking about the same subject. Yeah. I'd say it in 20 words, and you'd be there 20 minutes listening to him talking about the same process.
Going,
you know,
around.
And then we were sitting chatting one time, and he said that he envies the way that I talk, because I cut the fat off a conversation and just and get the same answer as him.
Yeah.
And he was saying how he overthinks and overprocesses things. So that's when I realised that, you know, my voice is sort of as valid as his, although in less words.
It's rich. You know, there's a richness to it. It's lovely, you know. You know, the classic art school pop, well, he's more Essex, isn't he? It's Ian Dury, you know, it's just like...
And who was at UEL as well at one point? He tutored there
years ago.
At the old...
at Greengate.
At the old site.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Mike, if there was you and five other artists, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the first one's obviously going to be Mr. Ragnar Carton's son. At... I guess we could have Jonathan Meese in there. Yeah. That's M-E-E-S-E. A.R. Penk. And a bit of...
I don't know A.R. Penk.
Yeah, P-E-N... Is it C-K or K? Yeah.
So I'm going to be rude enough while you're talking. I'm going to have a look. P-E-N-C-K.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I like a bit of Pipilotti Rist. She's like a filmmaker, immersive artist, R-I-S-T. And I like Sigmar Polke, or Polk, P-O-L-K-E.
Yeah.
I was trying to... There's Laura Prevost.
Okay.
Yeah, she's really cool.
If you wasn't an artist, what would you like to be?
Maybe... a forestry person, what do you call them? Yeah.
A forester?
A forester, yeah. Someone outside in the forest, yeah, doing a bit of tree husbandry.
But where did that idea come from, do you think?
Well, I love it. I love being in a forest and the trees, just the experience of that. I was going to say, the other thing that I would definitely like to do is be a sailor, but I'd like to know how to sail and be part of a crew. And yeah,
Si's the one to speak to.
Oh, well,
Si Sapsford. Well, she was at sea for 7 years.
Wow. Oh, I'll talk to her about that.
So you like the open and the sort of being away from people?
I was talking about that to a friend of mine. Remotely through the internet, how in lockdown, you know, that sort of isolation of going for a walk and people being on their own. And I was sort of thinking, yeah, I sort of get that, but I don't totally concur. It's like, actually, when I'm in that is when I feel connected to everyone. And yeah, that doesn't mean I don't want to be with people ever. It's just
moments of solitude.
Realigning my sense of connectedness. Yeah, it sounds sort of cosmic, but I think it's fundamentally true that no one's added anything to the universe since the Big Bang. So it's all fucking the same stuff. So it's all connected. it's useful to separate it, but it's not the factual be-all and end-all. Like, I was lucky enough, my parents took us camping when I was growing up, and they weren't like Keith in Nuts in May. I don't know if you've seen that. they weren't like that. And it was relaxed, but it gave me that taste for the landscape, the outside, that...
Yeah.
Enfolding in of me and people, the landscape, you know. So last year I sort of enforced Meg and the boys, we went on like a canoe trip up nice. The River Ouse, is it, in Bedford. And the people that had the canoes, they had their own forest. So like we paddled up to this forest, which was like a little tributary off the main river. You go down it, and then we're in a forest, just us.
Excellent.
And that was pretty awe-inspiring. It was, it was a bit scary, you know. Oh, well, I was going to say, we haven't really talked about the sort of the virtual and latency, but I got interested in the sort of half-second delay that we get in this kind of conversation. And one of the artist writers that I love is this guy, Brian Masumi. I'll finish on this, because he talks about how there were scientific experiments where they found that your sense of movement and touch actually happens prior to the bit of your brain that thinks it's deciding. So yeah. We fucking live in this realm where we think we're deciding everything. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But actually, we're feeling much more than we realise. That's a scientist called Libet, and it's the latency experiments. And Masumi sort of said it's because the skin is faster than the word. And that's in his book Parables for the Virtual. So what I love about that is like he wrote this like 10 years ago, and now suddenly here we are in the virtual. And I just sort of thought it's like an opportunity, because we're in the virtual, to live in that more felt way. Because the conceptual brain sees that realm as virtual because it's outside its understanding. So it's like, yeah,
nice.
Have it.
Finally there. What have you got coming up at the moment?
Yeah, at the moment I've got Blakefest, and I've been curating that for the last 3 years. And we're about to launch the Blakefest website, which is blakefest.com. And it sort of emerges out. My friend Rachel Searle sort of is the main director, and she asked me to curate the art side. And it's about the fact like Blake lived in Bognor Regis, and that is where he wrote Jerusalem and Milton and Auguries of Innocence, you know, to see heaven in a wildflower, all that. That's like while he lived 3 years in Bognor Regis, and it's about trying to bring that creative richness to the area but proliferate it far beyond. And so we've curated a new show of public art, Corona Visions, and then I've asked some friends, I think I asked you, and I've made a show called Virtual Visions, which is all about that realm of the excess beyond the algorithm, the virtual. Nice. And I've really enjoyed doing that. But I've written a song for Blakefest, because a friend was saying, oh, you should do something quite ambitious. So I thought, I wrote this song as I walk in the garden, and I've made a film for it, and the David Devont have enriched sound. So we're going to launch that song as I walk in the garden, you know, like Blake and the foot, and the earth and the landscape and the sort of transcendence of like the ordinary through the landscape, you know. Yeah. So not something highfalutin, but just passion. So I'm
excited.
Well, hopefully beginning of next week we'll be launching it. Nice and easy. Excellent. Website, blakefest.co.uk. So it was nice to make a sort of a song, a poetic music video, bringing everything together, you know, which is like Blake, isn't it? Because his art was songs and images and technology. He like fucked with technology to be innovative. Sorry to use a rude word, but it's kind of quite, it gets there, doesn't it? You know, it's like he got under the bonnet of what he could do with printing technology, And I sort of feel a bit like that with digital moving image technology.
And yourself, where can anyone see your work, be it online or social media?
Yeah. Well, there is a selection of my stuff on my website, mikeygeorgeson.com. And on Instagram, I'm slightly more tangential. I do post my morning drawings on Blood and Brambles. That's all words. That's Instagram. So I have a practice where every morning I get up, write 3 pages, and then I film a drawing as it emerges.
I love those drawings, Mikey. Yeah. Them little linear.
Yeah.
I enjoy waiting to see what's coming up.
Well, it's going to happen. That's the thing I love, emergence. So I don't know what I'm going to draw when I put the camera on. And it will undoubtedly be a mixture of neurosis and inspiration.
Anyway, Mikey, that's all my questions asked.
Awesome. So
thank you so much for your time. It was great to meet you.
It's a total pleasure to be on your podcast, Gary, because I sat in that audience and I thought, wow, that is someone who loves what they're doing. And that I love the fact that you just thought, you know what, I'm going to do this podcast. And you've done it with all these great names on there. I'm not just trying to flatter you, but so.
Splendid, thank you.
Yeah, so I'm on that. And I love that you know Stu Whiffin.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I mean, he's such a positive person. I love chatting to him.
Well, there we go, Mikey Georgeson. I absolutely loved recording this episode. I hadn't met Mikey before, but I had heard him talk about his work. And I was well aware of how beautifully he could talk about it. And his exhibition, Blakefest, has just opened. You can go and find out more about that on his Instagram page, which is Blood and Brambles. And if you don't know of his group, David Devont and his spirit wife, just YouTube it. It is something of sheer delight. At the start of this podcast, I told you about my dark stars. This is an edition of handmade, hand-painted barbed wire stars. I made an edition of 30 in Christmas 2018, and they absolutely flew out. So this year, I've decided to make more. They're called the Dark Star because three wise men followed the Bright Star. And well, we all know the end to that story. However, silly bollocks here, several years ago, followed a Dark Star. We pretty much all know the end of that story as well. But as I say, these dark stars are handmade in barbed wire. The sizes vary. They are approximately 50 centimetres high and maybe 35 wide. And I know of the last edition, Gavin Turk had one, Carrie Reichart, Ben Ein had one, Marcus Harvey, Emily Malice, among many, many others. So this year, I've done several different colours. There is a black gloss, red, green, gold, silver and copper. And all of which are available on pre-order at £85 plus £10 UK post and packaging. And on November the 1st, the price goes up to £99 plus £10 UK post and packaging. You can see these on my Instagram page, which is MizogArt, MizogArt. So that's all for now. But like I say every week, on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really helps us get noticed and anybody else looking for an art podcast. So, thank you for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.